Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start. All Future Thinkers episodes are now on video. To watch the premiere of each episode and join the discussion live, subscribe to our YouTube channel at FutureThinkers.org/YouTube. Hey guys, our guest in the next two episodes is Douglas Rushkoff, a media theorist, lecturer, and author of Team Human, as well as a dozen other books on media, technology, and culture. In recent years, he's become a critic of technology for separating us from what makes us human.
In the first part, we discuss the still untapped possibilities of digital technology, the causes and potential solutions to dystopian visions of the future, as well as transhumanism and its assumptions about human nature. For all the links and show notes, go to futurethinkers.org/93. The second part of the interview will be available at futurethinkers.org/94 once it goes live in about a week or so.
One small note before this interview, we had some connection problems, so that's why we had to break it up into two parts, and that's why some parts are kind of funny.
Check out A Course in Personal Evolution, adapting age-old wisdom for a modern life of purpose and meaning. Go to futurethinkers.org/evolution. What are you seeing when you look at the landscape of the digital world and humanity and their state of evolution? What are you seeing? What kind of problems?
I mean, that's kind of big. I see mainly that people and organizations seem as dreadfully unaware of the possibilities for digital technology as they were when they first emerged. You know, I remember back in the late 80s and early 90s, and I would tell people that this stuff was coming, you know, whether it was digital or hypertext or fantasy role playing or open-ended stories or the psychedelic revival or the Gaia hypothesis or morphogenetic fields, any of that. And they were all like, what's that for? How does that help? They were kind of clueless as to, why would I ever want email in my life? Why would I ever want to go on this computer and find things from other places? And I feel like people still have no idea what those possibilities are, and that this whole landscape got reframed by the business community as a way to, you know, accelerate the extraction of resources from the planet and time and energy from humans, a new way to monopolize money or to stoke more efficiency or enhance the utility value of people as workers and output. And so what we did was we took the world we were living in, this kind of yuppie, utilitarian, capitalist, boring thing, and we digitized that rather than exploring the possibilities of digital to open up a new paradigm, a new way of being, a new connected participatory culture. So I feel like digital still hasn't happened. What we're seeing now is the reaction of traditional nation state corporate capitalism against the possibilities of a connected participatory culture.
I find it very interesting how people do tend to react to the dystopian version of every possible future scenario. It seems like any fiction we watch now on Netflix is really about the ultimate destruction of the human species. And we almost celebrate it like, you know, finally we got what we deserved.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that, as I see it, you know, that's dystopia is a reflection of a lack of imagination.
Yes.
In other words, if you take the way things are and speed them up with digital, then that's what you're going to get. So if we're still in the society that enslaved hundreds of thousands of Black people and brought them over from Africa, if we haven't learned from that experience. We haven't, you know, not that we are going to make reparations here in the States, which we should, but if we haven't learned from that, then how are we going to choose a different path? So when, you know, the most imaginative people we have try to imagine scenarios where, okay, human nature is going to stay in this weird colonial, you know, this colonial mindset, and this alienated, anti-indigenous understanding of the world. And we're going to use digital tools and automate things and develop robots and consciousnesses and whatever that live by those rules, the rules that we understand, then how could you imagine anything else? All you can get to is Westworld or zombie apocalypse.
What do you think it is that causes us to believe that reality is not more malleable than it is? And to think that, you know, like the billionaire story you told, we have to shelter ourselves in a bunker from the inevitable collapse?
I mean, partly it's that the people in institutions with the most money have the best propagandists. Mm. You know, that things that serve capitalism end up making more money. You know, and if they make more money, then we say, oh, look, there's consumer demand for that. You know, so the folks in Hollywood will say, oh, well, you know, movies that have definitive endings and where there's, you know, these male heroes that win stuff or, you know, whatever those structures are, this kind of superhero structure, if that leads to more ticket sales, then it must be what people actually want. So we're promoting some kind of a democratic reality, but it's kind of a fixed game. That's like same as saying that, oh, if people are going to click on, you know, a white supremacist shooting people in a mosque, if that's what they're going to watch on Facebook, then that's the content they really want. And it's like, no, it's because Facebook has been designed to bring people into their most reptilian brainstem, impulsive, anti-human, alienated state. So when you're in that place, in that mode, you're going to revert, you know, and choose the most destructive, violent kinds of content. It's not that we really want it.
Even if Facebook accidentally designed it that way, which obviously they haven't, but to say that that's what we want because we're responding to fear, don't you think they would have to have some sort of response of responsibility to make the algorithm more healthy for us? Maybe kind of put blinders on the certain things that make us, I don't know, unconscious?
They only do that to the extent that it makes them money. Mm-hmm. You know, so now Facebook sees, oh, there's American politicians talking about regulating us. There's a lot of consumers and journalists saying that we suck. So we're going to have to do whatever we have to make people like us or, you know, not get regulated. And it's always, you know, two steps forward, one step back. So they'll say, oh, you know, okay, so now we'll, you know, if Mark Zuckerberg makes a big announcement that, oh, Facebook is going to be about privacy and that's what we're going to promote now. I mean, you see, really what he's doing is saying, oh, we're going to be about privacy. And that's my justification for bringing all of these separate companies that I bought into one, into one platform and having, you know, even tighter monopoly control. So, no, it's a sort of a cynical response that they'll have until they've gotten us used to the next level of surveillance.
Where do you think it went wrong? I mean, it's probably difficult to pinpoint, but how did we become so out of touch with our own evolved nature that it seems like there's kind of multiple levels of reality happening at the same time, where on one hand, we're these hairless apes that still have all of our communal instincts, you know, we're hyper-social animals. But on the other hand, we have this other reality that's hyper-individualist, hyper-capitalist, that exists at the level of narrative that actually has no substance to it. And we're existing in them simultaneously. Yeah. Where do you think that started? I mean, if it's possible to pinpoint at all.
You know, the best I can tell is it started when we shifted from a nomadic species to a domesticated one. You know, it was the sedentary lifestyle, the establishment, when we moved from sort of from lean-tos, which were little temporary, almost tents that we used to build as we wandered around, to structures, to little sedentary homes. That once we had homes, that's when the subjugation of women began, because the woman was kept inside the home and the man would go out. You had this sort of private secret life inside the home, or the women could be abused and the children were owned and the man was in charge. And then this public life where you kept this other stuff private. So you had sort of these two worlds. That was like the original virtual reality, was the strongest one in the little hut could create rules that the other ones had to live by. And, you know, that led to a whole lot of things. That's when men started caring about their kin, you know, their own offspring, more than the group of people that they were with. You didn't even know really who your kids were before. Maybe the mothers did, but the men didn't know so much. And they traded their children with other tribes whenever they passed in the, you know, they traded their kids so that they would have, you know, more genetic variation. So you could look at that. You know, a lot of people blame agriculture, but I think it was more the sitting still. Now I've got this property and now I've got to defend it. And there weren't really wars between wandering humans until they had these places. You could look at that as the moment. I mean, but that moment keeps happening. There are these opportunities throughout history. And for me, I guess because I study, you know, media and communications and technology, it feels like that these moments of opportunity are punctuated by the emergence of a new way of interacting with each other, whether it was language or being able to write things down, or the printing press, or now the internet. So in my lifetime, the shift between television and the internet seemed like one of those windows of opportunity, that instead of having to absorb the programming of William Randolph Hearst or Rupert Murdoch, that now we were getting these devices and we could become the media and you know, let all that stuff we were talking about before happen. All this, you know, Gaian quantum connected, you know, fractal fantasy rave psychedelic communion. And you know, I mean, and I've talked about this, that the internet was the equivalent of a psychedelic experience. It was, and even Timothy Leary said it was as powerful as LSD. Only we didn't get to establish the set and the setting for this powerful psychedelic. You know, Wired magazine established the set and setting, and they said they established what this trip was going to be about. It's not about human connection. It's about the NASDAQ stock exchange. It's about making money and accelerating the economy into a new growth, a new century or two of growth. And that, you know, it sacrificed this human renaissance to the needs of the same old market that we developed in the early Renaissance to prevent the communion between people.
It seems like you've also captured the early optimism of the blockchain space, when people thought they were going to make their own version of Facebook or, you know, these different kind of monopolistic companies and then release it and everyone would own a piece of it. But obviously it hasn't turned out that way either.
Yeah, I mean, it's still early, but you can say that this thing that happened in the, you know, what took 200 or 300 years to happen in colonialism took 20 or 30 years to happen with the internet, and took 2 years to happen with the blockchain, where this thing for distributed possibility ended up becoming a Ponzi scheme for investors. You know, really the poster child, the business plan. It's not even that these technologies actually make money or do anything. It's that people are willing to bet on them. Although, and then, you know, so we just had the equivalent of the dot-com crash with the blockchain. What happens then is all these people come with these new social peer-to-peer apps and possibilities. And then some of those will get invested in, and then those ideas will pivot towards extractive, you know, business aims instead of whatever these great blockchain goals may have been.
So where to from here? How can we, if every new technology seems to be repeating the same pattern, do you think that this is also somehow part of human nature that we keep repeating the same mistakes? Or is it the narratives that drive the thing that mess up? Where do you think the error is?
I guess we're going to find out. You know, if it's, I don't believe it's some core human nature. I think that if we buy the model or the story of human nature that's, you know, being sold to us or presented to us by the libertarians, this sort of, you know, Ayn Rand understanding of Darwin as this competition between individuals, and everyone is a self-interested economic actor competing against all the others for their piece. If that's what we choose to believe we are, then I don't know if we'll see. We'll get a way out. If we can, you know, if we can retrieve or recall, you know, what it is that we actually are, which is a collaborative, cooperative species. And if we can recall accurately that evolution is the story of how different species, you know, cooperate, you know, amongst themselves and with each other for mutual flourishing, and look at every example from, you know, trees to animals to humans to culture, then, you know, we stand a chance of saying, oh, right, this is who we are. I enjoy being with other people. I like helping and being helped, you know, then we stand a chance. So now I'm alone.
Oh, there we go.
You're back.
Last thing I heard is that you were talking about how everything is interconnected in nature, and how we're hyper social animals, and we still have that in us.
Yeah, if we just have to be able to recall that and retrieve that, you know, and if we don't, if we buy into the fiction that we are competitive individuals, like, you know, Hayek would describe, or Margaret Thatcher, you know, that we're all, you know, competing as rational economic actors, then you know, we will, I think we would be surrendering human nature to one abstraction, yeah, you know, to an idea. And it's interesting, you know, and one way of looking at it is that we keep having different abstractions, you know, that first we have the abstraction of capitalism, or the abstraction of consumerism, or the abstraction of, you know, the digital selves. But we could call all the abstractions just one thing. You know, there's the abstraction.
Maya.
You know, and the, yeah, exactly. And that's Maya, right. And we keep finding new homes for it. But each of these homes for our abstraction are this opportunity to wake up. You know, it's just like the mirror is an opportunity to wake up, or the mirror is an opportunity to get obsessed with your, you know, Botox or something, you know, with your face. And it's like, which way do you go with it? So that's why I like the development of new technologies, because each one is like another opportunity to wake up from the dream, or, you know, to go further in.
Mm-hmm. This reminds me of our conversation we had earlier today about transhumanism, where we kind of, what was your stance on transhumanism from what you were talking about?
Oh, well, we got a couple of Twitter questions, and one of them was, why are you anti-transhumanism? And then we were just discussing that between the two of us. And I said that I was kind of interested in the ideas of transhumanism a couple of years ago, but the more meditation I did and the more psychedelics I did, the more time I spent in nature, the more I realized that transhumanism is kind of silly in the way that it's being talked about. It completely misses our nature and what we're all about. And it talks about this kind of external thing, like we're going to upload ourselves somewhere else into the cloud, or we're going to create robots that, you know, will take our space on this planet, and we'll just retire from existence.
Or we'll stop being human altogether.
Yeah, we'll stop being human when we merge. But it misses what the center of all of this is, and the center is being. How do you create something that isn't being. I mean, you know, and we talk about uploading our consciousness to the computer, and that just, the more I think of that, the more that seems like such a ridiculous proposition.
Yeah, I mean, but you got to understand, people are afraid of being, you know, they're afraid of who they are. And there's a, you know, there's a long history of people and movements of trying to escape, you know, escape the body, escape who we are. It's, it's scary to people. So they, you know, look for, I mean, it's part of the existential questions you were asking before, you know, that people are afraid to die. You know, that's a big one. So they figure if they can get out of the body somehow before the body dies, then they get to go on, you know, or that they just don't like the body and other people and intimacy and wet and ugh, you know,
it's like meat bags.
You know, they're aching for, you know, they're in some ways so in love with the abstraction we were talking about,
yeah,
that how could they participate purely? So it's like if you're a mathematician and you just want to be in math somehow, you'd just get out of the body and never have to go poop or anything, mm-hmm. you know, and just go live in the equations. It feels, you know, it's so platonic. It's so idealistic. And it gets you away from all the messiness of stuff and women and, you know, all the things that they're afraid of.
The paradox, the weirdness, the ambiguity, all the uncomfortable, non-dualistic bits, basically.
Yeah, which is where I think where the fun lives, you know? That's where and it's not just stoners that want that. It's the liminal places between things, though. It's what you see in a you know, David Lynch or Wim Wenders or Kubrick movie or Kandinsky or Escher, you know, the great artists of our time are all playing with this these in-between liminal spaces that humans can go, and right now computers can't.
This is where I get confused about transhumanism, though, because I've thought of it as an increase in resolution of all of our senses.
Hmm.
And I mean, I think when a lot of people think about transhumanism or merging with technology, think of it as this cold, metallic, metal, silicon kind of like de-res version of our existence. But I've never, I mean, you've even brought this up a few times in one of your talks or one of your interviews about the little device that buzzes at you when you're facing north.
Right.
I love that idea. Like anything get that one. Could augment your senses. That's brilliant.
Get one. Do you find it sexy if you had one of those on?
Oh, she's already, she puts up with way worse than that. Way worse.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, the thing is, you got to understand, when you choose to increase the resolution of a particular sense, you're also numbing and in some ways amputating the possibilities of another one.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
That's the clue. For each thing that you amplify, you are relatively decreasing something else.
Is that because of a limitation in the brain's ability to process?
Well, partly it's partly because of the bias of the medium. So I have a smartphone, and the smartphone lets me talk to someone who's far away while I'm walking down the street. But as I do that, I'm going to lose my sense of the other people who are around me. I might get more likely to be hit by a car, but that's only the existential problem. It's the I'm making a choice. This is what Kevin Kelly keeps talking about. Technologies give us choices, but sometimes we implement the technology without even thinking about the choice or the trade-off or the opportunity cost that we're making. And the technology is coming. People are going to develop the technology no matter what. Technology is going to evolve. That's sort of what he's arguing, that there's an inevitability to, and that's one of his books even, there's an inevitability to the development of technology. The only question is whether human beings are going to steer that or not. Are we going to make conscious choices about where it goes or not? And he's a little disturbed by people like me who might be saying, ugh, I've had enough of this. I just want to enjoy other people now. Because if I don't stay part of the kind of technology development community, if other humanists don't, then it's going to be just the wired people that keep making this stuff, or the weapons people who work with this stuff. So he's like, you've got to become, if you're not part of the solution, then you're part of the problem. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sick of it personally, you know, so I would rather have my influence on the development of technology be this, you know, loud call for flesh and blood and presence and real world. I think that even technology developers who have good sex and who walk in the woods are going to be better, make better tech than the ones who are just sitting in the basement of Google doing what their masters tell them.
Agreed. Yeah, I actually wanted to draw a parallel with any kind of exploration. I mean, just the abstract concept of humans going out there into the unknown, you always have to come home and integrate and bring something back, you know, either to the tribe, or if you're exploring the far reaches of consciousness, you have to come back and ground and integrate that experience. And I think it's kind of the same with what we're doing with technology right now. As a human organism, I mean, as a whole, all of humanity, I don't think we've integrated yet what we're doing with technology. We haven't integrated these insights. And that's why it feels so divided to me.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many insights people are even getting from the technologies. You know, at least, I mean, when I, you know, if you walk around, you know, Uber or Facebook or Twitter, you're not engaging with people who are excited about what they've unleashed about, you know, the collective human organism. You know, they might be excited that, oh, look, we can render this with less RAM, or, you know what I mean? Or that I don't need as many server cycles to do this or that. And that's nice. That's beautiful. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, and you could blame the 1960s and 70s folks, because, you know, they had a tremendous series of insights about who and what we are, but they fed them right into consumerism and personal development and self-help and, you know, EST and neurolinguistic programming and these very Western manipulative, self-centered understandings of spirituality. You know, it was to build your house in San Rafael and have your own little meditation room and your personal guru, and you sit alone and get self-actualized. And that, I mean, that's a dead end. You know, that's the direction that so many people want to go with tech, you know, especially, you know, young men afraid of women. It's like, well, I could get this gorgeous Japanese, you know, sensory robot girl thing and never have to deal, you know, with all the messy scariness of, I mean, human intimacy is scary. We got to admit that. It's scary because there's like mother issues that come up, and projection and behavior, and it's a whole friggin' thing. And if you have an easy way out.
So your version of transhumanism seems to be where we kind of shut off those human capabilities for sensing.
Trans is an interesting word, right? So, or an interesting, because there's like transgender to me feels like a lateral move. Whereas transhumanism sounds much more to me like transcendence, trying to transcend, to rise above. You know, I don't think a transgender person would say, oh, I'm beyond gender. I'm above gender. It's more that they're liminal, that they're, do you know what I mean? It's, oh, do you froze again? You disappeared again. See, you are the trans technology people, and I'm the one who is staying here. You've transed me. You've transcended. I'm alone. That's another reason I don't want people to be transhumanists, because they're going to leave me behind. Like I'm left behind now. This is it.
And this is where we left Douglas when the connection broke down, so we continued talking the next time. You can find all the links and show notes for this part at futurethinkers.org/93, and part 2 will air next week at futurethinkers.org/94. And if you want to stay up to date with our latest episodes, blog posts, or news from Future Thinkers, join our mailing list at futurethinkers.org/mailing-list. To meet like-minded people, join our Future Thinkers Discord community. Go to futurethinkers.org/discord.
Check out A Course in Personal Evolution, adapting age-old wisdom for a modern life of purpose and meaning. Go to futurethinkers.org/evolution.
Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.